on The Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, it's the season of Easter, and all of the things that happened and the great start that happened and the triumphal entry on Palm Sunday, and then there is Good Friday. And on Good Friday, when the day was over and the Sabbath began, even though they had been told, no one knew what was going to happen on Sunday. So we're going to look at Good Friday, and we're going to look at the people who were there to see it happen. And we're going to look through the eyes of a particularly distinguished scholar. So we're really excited to welcome Dr. Amy Jill A.J. Levine back to On the Bookshelf. Her newest book is Witness at the Cross, A Beginner's Guide to Holy Friday. It's from Abington Press. A.J. is the Rabbi Stanley M. Kessler Distinguished Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Hartford Seminary and University Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies Emeritus. And we are very pleased to have A.J. back with us again today. And what better time to talk about the witnesses at the cross. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for welcoming me back. Although I do wonder that, you know, when you cite my emeritus status at Vanderbilt and my job now at Hartford International, and I'm a distinguished scholar, that people are going to think, oh my God, it's all this academic, fancy words, obscurant theological jargon. And I want people just to think of me as like their friend AJ who really cares about the gospel.
There you go. I think the fact that you're the co-editor of the Jewish Annotated New Testament, that's pretty fascinating. I probably should have led with that.
We're thinking now about doing a third edition of this for Oxford University Press. So, like, wow. There's another 3 years out of my life.
Oh, what's three more years? That should be absolutely fascinating, though. And I should mention that last year you were elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. That's not small potatoes.
Yeah, I got friends in good places, and I got lucky. But thank you.
When we think about the people at the cross, I think one of the things that makes the study of who was there the most interesting is probably what confuses people who are casual students of the Bible, and that is that the four Gospels have different stuff to say. And we think, because of the way that history books are organized now, that all of the facts should always line up absolutely perfectly or there's something amiss. But as you point out, this is four different people, two of whom were probably there, two of whom we're not sure if they were there or not. One of them we know for sure wasn't there. It's their account based on their observations. And that doesn't mean that they're all going to notice the same things or that they're all going to report the same thing.
I think we should celebrate the diversity that we have four different lenses by which to understand what happened. I actually don't think any of them was there. And if they were, the events happened decades before, and as we very well know, memory is fragile and eyewitness testimony is not always great. So I think it was brilliant that the Gospels give us four different ways of understanding this, and then we can understand more if we think about the soldiers at the cross and what they were seeing, or the centurion who has different things to say in Mark and Matthew on the one hand and Luke on the other. What about the women? Are they up right by the cross like the mother of Jesus and Mary Magdalene in the Gospel of John, or are they looking on from a distance, which is what Mark tells us? What about those two criminals, as Luke puts it, evildoers, who were crucified along with Jesus only in Luke? And then we can think about the different things that Jesus has to say. So all these sermon series about like the seven last words, there are actually more. Why don't we try to get a different perspective and say, can we imagine ourselves dying alongside of Jesus? Can we imagine ourselves at a distance, even afraid to come up too close to the cross if we feel unworthy or we feel that we might be arrested as well? What are the bystanders and the scoffers thinking, and what do we do when we see injustice being carried out today? Do we scoff? Do we look on from a distance? Do we try to provide comfort? All these stories open up these questions and many, many more.
They bring us into the event. They bring us into the moment, and we experience it. I love there's a passage in your book where you talk about we feel the wind blowing and think of the Spirit. We hear of the tearing of the veil and think not, as traditionally was taught to me. This demonstrates that the Jews had been keeping the Gentiles out, but that's not true because the outer court was the court for Gentiles and women who came to worship at the temple. Nobody got into
God's available to everybody, right? God's available to everybody all the time.
Right.
So if the idea that the rending of the veil makes God available, well, then God had been trapped and that wasn't the case.
Right.
So we need other ways of understanding the symbolism.
Yeah, and so you explained that the symbolism is likened to the tradition of tearing one's clothes to indicate mourning, that creation is ripped asunder by this sea change and what's happened, that God himself would take on human flesh and die is something that nature would never be able to completely understand and reconcile. I think that makes much more sense theologically and culturally than the old paradigms. And that's one of the things that I like about your book, that you help us to really appreciate the Jewishness of Jesus and of the people who were there. Because sometimes we kind of, in the church, we kind of forget, you know, these were all Jews that were there, except for the Roman soldiers. And even some of the Roman soldiers seemed to be, you know, sympathetic or not completely that far from understanding what it meant to follow the one God. So we paint ourselves in a Christian corner sometimes and do not think about the significance of these things happening in the culture in which it happened.
Yeah, that was really well put. I don't think you need to make Judaism look bad in order to make Jesus look good and in order to give the story some sort of meaning.
Right.
And it's tragic to me that when you have a story about an innocent man being put to death, what happens? You increase the bigotry by blaming the Jews rather than looking at the story in historical context. So we can do better with Good Friday.
Yes. To me, reading the Bible is all about context. If you don't understand, then you're like a person who just drops open the Bible at any point and says, I'm going to follow whatever God tells me to do today. Let's drop it open.
Then you land in Job and things are bad.
Yes. Or you land and you read, and he went out therefore and hanged himself of Judas. These are not places you want to drop in. If you don't understand the context, you're just reading willy-nilly like you're reading, and then you miss what's going on, and you miss what the Spirit is bringing to you.
I think that's partially right. I think anybody can actually pick up a Bible and read it, not just one verse, but read the text at least in some sort of narrative context.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get a message from it, and it's a message of challenge or inspiration or hope or consolation, that's terrific. You've gotten something.
Right.
Because the Spirit's going to lead you there. But if you really want to do it well, then do a little bit more work. It seems to me that if we take seriously the idea that of the incarnation, of God taking on flesh, right, then you might want to take seriously where and when it happened.
Right.
Because Christianity, like Judaism, is a time-based religion where God manifests in history.
Right.
So in the same way that if you fall in love with somebody, you want to know something about the background, like where did you go to elementary school, and tell me about your parents, and tell me about what sports you played as a kid. If you care about Jesus, you want to know about the time and the place where he lived.
What was it like to be a man who was a worker with his hands, as Jesus was?
Mm-hmm.
What was it like to be a man in first century Israel that was dominated by the Roman Empire? What was it like for the Jews that lived in these places? What long memories in places, and we as Americans particularly, I think, are challenged by the idea that things that happened 100 or 200 or 300 years ago would still resonate in the future, and yet they always do. These are very ancient places, and things had been going on in these places for a very, very long time, and people did not forget.
People didn't forget, but they always put a stamp from their own social location on what they were reading. So when we were reading the Gospels 100 years ago, we would be seeing very different things than what we're seeing today. And we asked different questions. 100 years ago, generally, people weren't asking questions about slavery, but particularly important when we start thinking about the war between the states, the Civil War. People weren't asking questions about women until feminists came along and said, gee, but what about the women? We weren't asking questions about political occupation. We weren't asking questions about economics. So if we read the text and the only thing we got is Jesus died to save us from our sins and that's it, then we're actually selling the New Testament short, because if that's the whole thing, you can start with the cross.
Yeah.
And you can start with the death. Why not backtrack a little bit and take time to read the words that the evangelist gave us?
We're talking, if you're just joining us, to A.J. Levine, who has done more than 500 programs for churches, clergy groups, and seminaries on the Bible's Christian-Jewish Relations and Religion, Gender, and Sexuality Across the Globe. She is the first Jewish person to teach New Testament at Rome's Pontifical Biblical Institute. Describes herself as an unorthodox member of an Orthodox synagogue and a Yankee Jewish feminist who taught New Testament in a Christian divinity school in the buckle of the Bible Belt up until 2021. Such a grasp on the Bible, it's from a different route than I took to get to it. But that means I can learn from you. And I always like learning from people.
We can all learn from each other. Yeah. To me, studying the Gospels is studying Jewish history. So I get to learn stuff about my own tradition that I did not learn in my synagogue, where we never talked about the New Testament,
right. Because
it's not scripture for Jews.
Right.
At the same time, right. But I also read with Christians to understand how people read through a Christian lens. This is sacred scripture to millions of people and therefore needs to be treated with utmost respect.
So let's talk about the witnesses. One of the things that has always struck me is that the women were there, and I've been told that in the first century that women had very few legal rights and would not be considered as credible witnesses. Is that true?
Wrong. I'm trying to be polite about this, but it's wrong.
Yeah.
That's one of those stereotypes that we have. So standard sermon, Easter sermon based on the Gospel of Luke, the male disciples did not believe the women when they came back after seeing the empty tomb because, of course, women's witnesses were not accepted. But that turns out to be totally wrong. That comes from very, very select rabbinic commentary written much later than the New Testament, retrojected back and universalized. If women's witnesses were not accepted, why did Peter and the beloved disciple, believe Mary Magdalene when she came and told them the tomb was empty, right? If women's witness was not accepted, why would Jesus have said to Mary Magdalene, go be the apostle to the apostles and tell the guys? I'm citing the Gospel of John here.
Right.
Of course women's witness was accepted. The reason the disciples don't believe the women is not because of the messengers. They don't believe the women because of the message, because they don't think Jesus is coming back.
Right. No,
it's the message.
Right. Nobody thought he was. Even though he said he was, nobody thought, oh, that means he's going to be resurrected, because that would just be an unbelievable thing.
Well, resurrection is on the books. I mean, Pharisees promulgated the idea of resurrection. Pretty much all Jews at the time believed in it.
Mm-hmm.
But they thought that there would be a general resurrection when everybody comes back out. You know, it was one person. That wasn't supposed to happen.
Right. That's what Mary and Martha
referred
to.
Raising of Lazarus. Yes, Lord, I believe in the resurrection on the last day.
Right.
Oh, and on that witness thing, if we go to the Gospel of John, Thomas hears the news from the guys. And he doesn't believe the guys, which tells us, again, it's the message, not the messenger.
Right.
So women at the time, women had access to their own funds. They show up in synagogues. They show up in the Jerusalem temple. They own their own homes. They show up in public, and nobody goes, oh, my God, it's the woman in public. So we would expect them to be there. So this idea that women are chattel and Jesus invents feminism in the pantsuit, just it's not historically valid. And it's undercutting these strong women who made a great contribution to the beginnings of the movement that Jesus founded.
So, what about the other people that were there? What about Simon of Cyrene? Obviously, people were in town for the Passover. These obviously were observant Jews that came to Jerusalem for the Passover. Simon is apparently one of those very people, correct?
It's possible Simon was a pilgrim. It's also possible that Simon, who lived in Cyrene, which is today Libya, moved to Jerusalem because a number of observant Jews who were living in the diaspora moved to Jerusalem when they could gather up enough of their family resources to relocate, because relocating is always hard. So he may have been a permanent resident. He may have been a pilgrim. What he allows me to do, at least, is, well, you know, let's talk about the Jewish community in Cyrene at the time, because there was a huge community in Cyrene. We know some of them relocated to Jerusalem because the Book of Acts mentions a synagogue of Cyrenaeans, and they're part of the group around Stephen. But it also allows us to say, well, what happened to that community subsequently? At the time of Jesus, there was a thriving Jewish community in Libya. Today, there are no Jews left in Libya at all. Talk about ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
So the text, it is an historical text, but it also helps us raise questions about the present.
So how about Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus? Are these guys fans of Jesus? Are they friends of Jesus? Are they followers of Jesus? there seems to be kind of contradictory information.
Yeah, you can watch a kind of spin going as we move from the earliest gospel, which is likely Mark, to Matthew, to Luke, and then to John. And Nicodemus only shows up in the Gospel of John, so it strikes me as a little odd that, you know, the Matthew, Mark, and Luke would have omitted him, because he's pretty important. He starts out as a council member in Mark, and then we learn that he's a council member, but he's not agreeing to the condemnation of Jesus. And then we find out he's a secret disciple. So it's if the gospel writers are just adding in these little details. No, he really is fine. He really is one of us. He could have been not a follower of Jesus at all, but as a pious man of his time, recognizing that you don't want to leave a body on the cross, recognizing that Jesus may have had some very, very good things to say, and has the courage, the chutzpah, to go to Pontius Pilate and say, I really like to entomb this body of a man whom you just executed, which could have gotten Joseph in a lot of trouble, but he has the courage to be able to do this.
Right.
At the same time, they don't think Jesus is coming back. In the Gospel of John, they entomb Jesus under 100 pounds of myrrh. That's a lot of myrrh.
Yeah.
They're thinking he's going to be dead for a very, very long time, and the myrrh is there to keep the smell of the decaying body from permeating and wafting out of the tomb.
And the tradition...
And I'm not, by the way, sure that Nicodemus ever gets it. He is a saint in various Eastern Orthodox communions. I'm not sure he ever came to belief in Jesus. He strikes me as just a really decent guy who's concerned about justice, but he's not quite there yet. So for me, he's like people who still go to church because that's what they always did, and they're not sure that everything that they're saying in the worship service, if they're reciting a creed, for example, or singing a hymn, they're not sure. I'm not sure I believe this. But I think it's an idea worth hanging on to.
Yeah. I think that these guys are certainly useful to ponder. And I remember doing a first-person sermon as Nicodemus one time, and first-person sermon of Joseph of Arimathea. And the idea was, we know a little bit about these guys, but we don't know everything about these guys. So what if? That makes a place for people to step off and say, well, what if I was that person in that situation? How would I feel? Mm-hmm. How would I have reacted? Because not everybody obviously agreed with the disciples. Even apparently Judas Iscariot had a different idea about what it meant to be a Messiah. So why not the people that followed Jesus or heard Jesus? They weren't all going to be of one mind. And I think that's important because all of us are on a path, a journey to understand God and understand our place in the world and understand what his vision for us is, what task has he set us about, or what calling has he put on us. And therefore, we're kind of all ad-libbing, you know. We're all improvising. We have great resources to help us understand, but we still have to do the lifting ourselves.
Pretty much. The Gospel of John makes it quite clear that God calls you, right? So there are certain people who get called, and there are certain people who just, you know, maybe that call is a little too silent. Maybe it's not there at all, but it doesn't stop you from being a decent person. So for me personally, I haven't felt that call. I'm fascinated by these stories, and they indict me, and they inspire me, and they challenge me, and I've spent my life studying them, but I've never felt that call. So I've got people praying for me. If you want to add me onto the list, that's fine. But, my own heart is just completely filled with my own Judaism, and I'm not finding this gap. So I identify with Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. Like, I really like this stuff, but I haven't gotten baptized, and I don't consider myself to be a Christian. But, boy, there are some great ideas going on here.
Yeah. And the fact that you're seeing it from a different side opens us up to discovering too, and I do think in a sense that is your calling, that you're a person that can make connections on both sides of this, because far too long, for so many centuries, relationships between our faiths have been so poor, and I'll admit that we're the ones that made it miserable. So it's, I think the fact that you have this opportunity to bridge a gap is, I think that's a pretty significant thing.
Well, thanks. I also spend time, a lot of time, talking to Jewish congregations about kind of Christianity 101, because there's ignorance on both sides, and both groups say unfortunate things about the other group.
Right.
So we all have a lot of learning to do. For my own work, I leave all of Christian theology in place. So if you believe everything the New Testament and the creeds claim about Jesus to be true, that's fine. I'm not challenging any of that. I'm just taking a step back and saying, well, gee, what might people have thought before these creeds got developed? Right. How might people have understood Jesus prior to the resurrection, especially if they don't think it's going to happen? And then we get a much richer sense of what that initial story might have been.
One of the things that I enjoy about trying to see a different way of interpreting things is interpreting the Old Testament, for example, the passages that traditionally Christians have said, oh, there's Jesus in there. Like Isaiah particularly, things that we interpret as being messianic prophecies that are fulfilled in Christ. But what did it mean to the Jews who heard him the first time? They weren't thinking, oh, well, you know, a couple of hundred years from now, we'll get all the answers to this. And I think that's something that helps inform my appreciation for prophecy and for the beauty of the Old Testament, that it's not just resource material. This is the Word of God.
Absolutely. A couple of years ago, I did a book with my Jewish Annotated New Testament co-editor, Mark Bretler, who teaches at Duke, called The Bible With and Without Jesus. And we fought for that "and" when the press wanted "or." And what we do is we take the major Old Testament, that's a good Christian term, we take the major Old Testament prophecies that get deployed in the New to say, you know, this is all pointing to Jesus. And we say, well, what did these texts mean in their original context? Because if Isaiah is giving a sign in 700 BC, 700 BCE, it's got to mean something to the people then.
Right.
So what did it mean in its original context? What else did it mean in Second Temple Judaism? Because then you can look at the Dead Sea Scrolls or Josephus or Philo, other Jewish literature at the time. And then what does post-biblical Judaism say about these texts? Because it's not as if non-Christian Jews were you know, ignoring Isaiah. They had stuff to say about Isaiah 7 and Isaiah 53 and Psalm 2 and Psalm 22 and so on. So read the Old Testament through Christian lenses. It's appropriate to see Jesus on every single page. But if you take off those Christian lenses and you put on non-Messianic Jewish lenses, you're going to see a whole lot more. And here, Christians are an advantage because they can double dip. They can take most of the Jewish reading and say, yeah, that makes sense too. Because the text is so robust, it's not as if, you know, Jesus fulfills it, so you put a little check mark next to it and say, you know, I'm done with that.
Right.
It's still got more stuff to do.
Yeah.
So we can say, who's the suffering servant today? Whose suffering calls us to social account?
I know that we are talking about your book, Witness at the Cross, but we've also had a chance to talk about the larger context also. And I noticed what time it is, and I realized, oh goodness, we're running out of time, and I probably should have given you a chance to talk a little bit more about your book. So is there something that you'd like to say about your book before we run out of time?
The Christian readers should not get all nervous that we have four different stories. The story of the death of Jesus is too magnificent and too important, too profound to be contained only in one story. That we can be any of those witnesses, we can step into their role, we can imagine using our good historical imagination what they might have seen and what they might have thought. And if we spend time with those witnesses, we wind up spending time on Good Friday instead of doing what so many people do, which is jumping immediately from Palm Sunday to Easter.
Right.
There's a reason we have these stories. The original gospel writers expected us to spend time with it. So if we can take some time out on Friday and live with these characters and imagine ourselves responding as well at the foot of the cross or looking on at a distance, I think we become better readers. I think Christians get to know their text better. I think Jews get to know their history better. And I think all of us are called to account when we see things like state torture, capital punishment, innocent people being persecuted, fearful women who are consoled by Jesus that their children will probably die in the war to come. We see so much, and then you just start listening to the news, and you can make the connections so tragically easily.
One of the things that studying the Bible reminds us is that we live in a world that's been broken. And how did people live out their lives 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago? Did they have the same hopes and dreams? Did they have the same expectations? Did they have the same concerns, the same fears? And these words that we believe are inspired by God have the power to remind us that it's not just our narrative, it's God's narrative, and he is still in control, despite our insistence that it's us. So that gives me hope and gives me courage. I think that's one of the great things that we get from studying the Bible, isn't it? Hope and courage.
I think that's spot on. Well said. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I always enjoy getting to read your books, and I always enjoy getting a chance to talk to you. So we'll have to do this again soon, okay?
I look forward to the next time. So happy Easter to you and all the people who listen to your wonderful show.
Thank you. And may your Passover be a blessed one, because I know Passover begins on Good Friday this year, right?
Yeah, well, you know, after a week of matzah, then you can ask me how I'm doing. It's all good.
It's a deal. All right. Our guest today has been A.J. Levine, who is the Rabbi Stanley M. Kessler Distinguished Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Hartford Seminary, and University Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies Emerita. And she's also a fascinating woman with an awful lot of information and insight to bring to us. And we're so glad that she came today to talk about her new book, Witness at the Cross, A Beginner's Guide to Holy Friday from Abington Press. You can check abingtonpress.com. And AJ, do you have a website of your own?
You can find me on the Hartford, it's now Hartford International University for Religion and Peace website. I've also got a Facebook page, and if somebody wants to study parables with me for an intensive course in June, Hartford is offering that course both on-site and online.
Very cool. All right. Thank you very much. A great blessing to get a chance to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our thanks once again to Dr. A.J. Levine, the author of Witness at the Cross, for her insight as to what happened on Holy Friday, and what does that mean to us today as followers of Jesus. Oh, thank you so much for joining us today. I know it's a little out of the ordinary us to have an Easter show that features a Jewish scholar, but Jesus is Jewish too. And the context of Holy Friday and the Passion is Jewishness. And I think that's important for us to understand, that informs our understanding of what the Bible has to say to us. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast if you're listening to me on onthebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Happy Easter. Christ is risen. He is risen indeed.